The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You know, NSA is having a nice respite. I was actually at a dinner last night on Thursday out in Virginia where Keith Alexander was sort of giving a valedictory kind of speech and, you know, before he steps down. And I believe it was Mike McConnell who got up and said some nice things, former DNI, former NSA director, about General Alexander. And he said, "I would like to thank John Brennan for taking the heat off the NSA this week." And Brennan, who originally had been scheduled to be at the dinner and unfortunately could not make it. The NSA is, I think, enjoying the vacation from people like me calling them up every day. But we'll be calling again. I'm Shane Harris with Foreign Policy Magazine, and this is the Lawfare Podcast.
And I'm Benjamin Wittes. Shane Harris was the first ever guest on the Lawfare podcast. That was episode 1. This is episode 66. Shane Harris is also the first ever repeat guest on the Lawfare podcast. I asked him to come by the Brookings studio this week to talk about a remarkable series of events in the news of national security and law. The flap between the Senate Intelligence Committee and the CIA, an incredible set of exchanges between the NSA and the FISA court and the U.S. District Court in the Northern District of California over whether the agency can, may, or must retain telephony metadata past the 5-year deadline. It's been a heck of a week, and you will not want to miss this conversation with Shane. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 66, A Conversation with Shane Harris. So Shane, what the heck is going on between the CIA and the SSCI?
Just a quiet week, you know, at the office. Where do we begin with this amazing saga that we've seen?
So let's begin actually with the story. Just the story as it's unfolded. It seems to me there's actually two different stories. Mm-hmm. One is the CIA's story, and the second is the SSCI's story. So let's take them in order. And start with sort of the world according to the SSCI, I think, which we know a little bit more of.
Right. So the world, the way this goes according to Dianne Feinstein and the members of the committee, mostly Democratic members of the committee, I think exclusively actually, is that back in 2009, Senate Intelligence Committee staff began the process of reviewing millions of pages, ultimately 6 million pages of documents regarding the CIA's interrogation and rendition and detention program. They had to review all these documents in a secure facility in Northern Virginia that the CIA chose and that the CIA set up for them, not at the Senate committee offices in the Hart Senate office building, which would be customary in this kind of an investigation. The probably 2 or 3 staffers at a time went out there, worked nights and weekends, and spent the better part of the next 3 years pouring through these records. And when we say pouring through them, what we really mean is that, as it's described, they were using computers connected to a network, a shared network, and a standalone hard drive that the CIA had set up for them. And the CIA would take document requests from the committee staff, look at them, go find the documents that responded to the request. The CIA and some contractors would scrub through those documents, blank out anything that involved, you know, perhaps names of sources or, you know, sensitive methods, take back anything that was covered by executive privilege, and then dump all of that data into a database. And the CIA or the Senate committee staff could look at it. What the committee staff contends is a couple of things happened. At one point in 2010, some documents that were in the database suddenly went missing. They also contend that at some point the staff discovered that there was an internal document to this internal CIA document that related to the interrogation program, which had not been made available to the committee staff as part of this data dump. How they managed to learn said document exists is something of a matter of contention, and this is where kind of the Rashomon element takes over. The committee staff says that they became aware of that document, printed out a copy of it and some related materials, I gather, removed it from the facility in a secure bag, and then took it back to the Hart Senate office building where it remains. That document now is largely referred to as the Panetta document or the Panetta report, and appears to be some kind of a summary of all of the documents that the CIA had been handing over to the committee. So there's that document that's at issue. There's this earlier set of documents that disappeared from the database. Senator Feinstein says she brought this up with the White House. It appears that those may have been covered by executive privilege and should never have been turned over. That matter appears to have been settled. The Washington Post is now out with a story saying there may be yet some more documents that the CIA inadvertently put into the database and took back. But the really contentious point from the Senate committee is this Panetta review. They say they should have had it all along. The CIA says, oh, no, you shouldn't have. So if we're looking at this from the CIA's perspective, what they will say – you know, not so much explicitly on the record, but what sources will tell you is that probably sometime in around 2012, the Senate committee started asking the agency about this so-called Panetta review. And the agency was wondering, what are they talking about? You know, what exactly is this document that you're referring to? And furthermore, why do you have it? The CIA will say that they then began a review of the audit logs that those committee staff were using in the facility to discover if there had been some kind of a security breach.
Now, hang on. So two questions this immediately raises. One is there any question that it was improper, but that it was improper for the SSCI staff to remove the Panetta review from that room? And secondly, is there any question that it was of the propriety, or to what extent is there a question of the propriety of the CIA secretly and without telling the committee reviewing the audit logs of access to that database?
Yeah, those are the two big questions. I mean, to take the second one first, this is the source, I think, of Feinstein and Udall and other senators' great outrage is that the CIA was going back and reviewing the logs of essentially what the committee staff looked at. They think that's completely out of bounds, that they take that as interference with the investigation, because that's where they get into the instance, this business of you were spying on our committee staff, which I think the CIA rejects flatly and completely. They would say, no. We have reason to believe that this document was on the other side of a firewall and that somebody on your staff somehow breached that firewall and took a document that they were never allowed to see and furthermore printed the document out and removed it from the facility that we had set up for you. So this – it really is a question, I think, of what were the ground rules that they set out at the beginning. What seems pretty clear is that each side, the CIA and the CISI, believes that the other fundamentally violated the ground rules. The CISI thinks that the CIA violated them in not turning over this document. The CIA thinks that the CISI violated them in taking a document that they never should have had and possibly breaching a computer system at the CIA to do it.
And removing it covertly.
And removing
from...
it. Right.
So,
right.
So should we think of this as an example of a case where one side has done something awful, or maybe both sides have done something awful? Or should we think of it rather the way I perhaps cynically think of a lot of executive oversight relations, which is simple power dynamics questions dressed up in language of principle, and that, you know, they'll yell at each other, you did this, no, you did this. But this is really just the push and pull of legislative oversight in sensitive areas, maybe ramped up a bit or a lot.
I think it's probably more the latter and then exacerbated by some pretty particular circumstances. I do not think that Dianne Feinstein intended in the previous months and years of this investigation to ever go on the Senate floor like she did on Tuesday and accuse the CIA of violating the Fourth Amendment and the separation of powers and all of the rest of it. I think that she has felt pushed to do this for two reasons. I think, one, she's very protective of her staff. She feels very strongly about the interrogation program. I think she clearly thinks that it was torture, that the CIA shouldn't have done it. But I think that the question remains of what was sort of the trigger that caused her to so vociferously go out there and escalate this in the way that she did. I think more likely what's happening is that this is being driven by other senators on the committee. I think Senator Udall has been very prominent in his criticism of the way that the CIA has been, in his view, withholding improperly information, as has the administration. It surfaced this week that back in, I guess it would have been 2013, when Mr. Preston was then the CIA General Counsel and was having his confirmation hearing to be the DOD counsel, Udall submitted a number of questions to him asking him about various documents that the administration was withholding from the committee. Clearly, this has been a subject of great concern for Udall particularly for at least a year, and I think that this is part of what's driving the latest sort of public flare-up of it, if you will. I mean, a lot of this kind of got started some months ago when Senator Udall alluded publicly, I think it was him the first time, to the fact that there was this thing that became known as the Panetta Report. So there's clearly been a push and pull behind the scenes that I think is part of the normal process, and now this has tipped over publicly and become, you know, a brawl.
Why is the Panetta Report or Panetta Review important?
To be honest with you, I don't know. Because I have yet to be persuaded that this document, which both sides purport to be a summary of the documents that were turned over as part of this discovery process to the committee, I don't understand the committee's argument still as to why they think that this document somehow bolsters or proves their case. The only thing that I can surmise, and what I gather from talking to some of my reporting, is that this is probably a document that largely consists of summaries of documents that were prepared by junior level staffers at the CIA or perhaps their contractors, and that it may contain summaries or analyses of those documents that the committee thinks are persuasive of its case. The CIA rejects the idea completely that this is some sort of separate internal review. And unless I'm missing something, I haven't heard anyone on the committee say, oh, no, the Panetta Report is much more than what they're telling you it is. I don't exactly know why they think that it somehow is a great bolster of their case, but they do.
So I've wondered if one of the reasons is that if you're the director at that time, one of the things you want as this investigation is getting started is a document that says what's the worst thing that SSCI could find based on the documents we're turning over to them. And so somebody prepares a document for you that comes to be called the Panetta Review that is basically what's the worst case scenario in terms of their findings based on all this material of ours, which would look to the committee like a kind of internal, not like an IG investigation, but a sort of what a roadmap almost to the most juicy things that they could find. But from the director's point of view, is merely a sort of prospective damage assessment in terms of the relationship with the committee. That was the only thing I could think of as
And it could also be, again, I'm just speculating here, but it very well may be that the Panetta Report has elements or leads the committee to conclude that there are other documents to which they've also not had access. I mean, it could be, and look, I mean, to the extent that They discovered that the agency was doing some sort of accounting that was not transparent to the committee staff that were working away in this secured facility. They may have felt that this was the CIA attempting to hide something from them. I mean, the level of mistrust, I think, on both sides here is pretty profound. I think it's exacerbated and it may cool down with time. But from the very beginning, I think the committee has felt very thrown off balance by the CIA's requirement that they go out to that facility. And they feel to some extent that they're being shown a lot, but not necessarily in a completely transparent way, if that makes sense. Let me give you a good example of this. I mean, Feinstein complained that when they submitted their request for documents to the CIA, I guess back in 2009, this corpus of material started growing very rapidly from hundreds of pages of documents to thousands to roughly over 6 million. And she claims that there was no index, there was no catalog, there was nothing, there was no chronological order to the documents. It was just, as she put it, a data dump or a document dump. And I think that they feel that that was a tactic meant to slow them down and to confuse them. I suppose if I'm in their shoes and I find out that actually, the CIA at some point started putting together a very neat index and catalog of all those documents. At the very least, I might say, hey, could you show us that? Because it would help the investigation.
So the other big thing that happened that ratcheted things up was that the CIA made a criminal referral with respect to the removal of the Panetta document. And the identity of the person who made that referral came to be a matter of controversy in its own right. What do you make of this?
I think that the agency feels that the Senate staff fundamentally violated the ground rules of the agreement, not to remove documents. Now, does that warrant a criminal review? Arguably, no. I think this is them probably saying – I think this is the CIA trying to up the ante. I mean, I think it's a way of them perhaps even – not to be too cynical about this, but to distract from the argument or even distract from the investigation and make this now a matter of criminal referral and say, okay, fine. The best way to maybe distract from the current circumstances is to create a whole new controversy. I mean, it's extraordinary. Nobody I talked to in reporting this story could remember a time – when an agency criminally referred a disagreement over handling documents.
On the other hand, Jack Goldsmith wrote on the site yesterday that the standard for criminal referral, for mandatory criminal referral, is actually very low. And he's not sure that given even the barest hint of possibility of illegality, that the CIA's general counsel's office had any choice but under the law but to make that referral, and that he thinks that justice will dispense with it relatively quickly, but there may have been very little option but to make the referral in the first place.
So that they feel, in other words, their hands were tied, they had to do something because the act of removing the document was such a basic violation of the agreement.
A possible violation of criminal law, and they are required to report to justice all possible violations of criminal law.
Well, I defer to Jack, obviously, on interpreting criminal law. But I guess I would just say two things. I mean, one, you know, not to take the Feinstein side on this, but I think she has a fair point when she says our staff knows how to handle documents. We know how to remove them from a facility and transport them to another and to do it in a secure way. We have great experience with this, she says, and the CIA doesn't deny this, that that's what they did with this document. They took it out of one facility at the CIA and moved it over to the Hart building. There's no accusation that somebody took it home or took it to an unsecured space. And from her perspective, she feels like they were justified or at least had some cause in doing this because the agency had demonstrated that it was willing to hide documents from them or pull documents back. I mean, I alluded to this set of documents in 2010 that suddenly disappeared that were once there. So I think that she feels in a way like they created a predicate for maybe justifiable bending of the rules. I mean, she wouldn't quite put it that way. But on the other hand, okay, so if there's a minimum standard and the CIA General Counsel feels that it has to refer this, there is zero chance that this is going to get prosecuted. I mean, I think it's more likely that Putin is going to invade Kiev, then the Justice Department is going to file charges against a Senate committee staffer for removing this document. And so, okay, so perhaps the CIA is just sort of following the rule book and doing its job by referring this. But they have to know that there's practically no chance that this will result in someone actually facing charges. So then you have to ask yourself, what is this? Is it a stunt? Is it a threat? Is it an intimidation tactic? Is it just needless escalation? You know, why didn't this get settled with a phone call? Why didn't it get settled with a conference?
Well, so at this point, it seems to me that the way it has to get settled is John Brennan and Dianne Feinstein have to sit together, down together and settle it.
They have to arm wrestle.
And okay. And what's the – I wouldn't like Feinstein's chances in that.
No, probably not.
What – I mean, what needs to happen in order to settle that relationship down at this point?
It seems like they probably have to get in a room together, although they have been in rooms together before and it hasn't really helped. You know, I think the White House is clearly trying to I think the word was de-escalate was the word that was reported recently. I mean, Kathy Rumler and the chief of staff of the White House all both went up to talk to Feinstein, it's been reported. I think there's going to be a bit of a cooling off period here. Whether or not, you know, Feinstein and Brennan can get along and recover from this. Look, the report is done, right? I mean, it's waiting to be declassified. Obama came out this week and said, I support the committee speeding this along. Get it to us so we can do the classification review and let's get it out there. I mean, ultimately, I think the way you settle this is by declassifying and publishing the report and letting people make up their own minds on it. That said, though, I think there's also maybe a healing between the staffs that have to go on here. The legislative affairs staff at the CIA and the CISI staff and Brennan's staff as well, because I imagine that the things that Brennan and Feinstein are saying are largely being told to them by their staff. And I'm not saying they're just being mouthpieces for this, but this is a staff fight about, you know, at some point as well. And that relationship needs to be repaired, it seems to me.
Now, one of the ironies here is that Feinstein has been chiefly known in public over the last 9 months as the NSA's most ferocious defender. Mm-hmm. And there's always been a little bit of a dichotomy between her relationship with the CIA, which has been conditioned by this investigation for a very long time, and her relationship with the signals intelligence side of things. But it seems particularly stark now, and I'm curious what you make of her role in this and just how we should understand, is this a fierce defender of the intelligence community, the angry watchdog over the intelligence community, both at the same time? How should we understand the person of Dianne Feinstein?
I thought a lot about that, and it's a great question. I think the best way to view her is as a fierce defender of the intelligence community in general, and also a fierce defender of her staff and their prerogative to do investigations of the agency she's supposed to oversee. I mean, again, I don't think that she imagined ever getting to this point where she was saying what she said about them on the Senate floor. I think she felt that she had to when it became clear that the agency and the staff had this fundamental disagreement and were trading these accusations about access to documents and documents being removed. And in that case, I mean, she's going to protect her own. I mean, I think she feels very protective of the committee's prerogative and the separation of powers, and that's what led to her outburst. I mean, you know, I should say her staff gave practically no notice to the press that she was going to do this. I mean, I think that there was no warning the night before. I know from talking to people who've worked around her and with her, she cares very, very deeply about the interrogation or the torture issue. I think for her, it's possible to be a fierce defender of the agencies and of intelligence operations and still have fundamental base disagreements with particular programs. So if you look at, you know, NSA, for instance, she's been largely a defender of NSA surveillance.
Except on the Angela Merkel stuff.
Except on the Angela Merkel stuff, exactly. Now, there may have been some politics, I think, as well. I think she felt probably the need to come out and condemned this very strongly to make it clear that she wasn't being wholly defensive of the NSA. And there, too, you know, she came out with a very impassioned statement, and she promised a top-to-bottom review of signals intelligence and all other intelligence operations, which I suppose is ongoing now, although we haven't heard much about it. So I think it's possible to see her as somebody who defends both, you know, the agencies in general, but also her committee and the process of investigation. And I'm sure that she's sensitive to accusations that have been made against her and House overseers and her predecessors on that committee, that the Senate and the House don't do real oversight, that they're not equipped to do it, that they don't have the political will to do it. And in this situation, you know, she had – I'm not saying that she calculated this completely on political terms, but there was a great case for her to make to come out and say this process has been meddled with in an unfair and unconstitutional way. She had great grounds, I think, to escalate and make that argument. And the CIA, you know, has its counterargument, which, by the way, they are not making as strongly. I think Brennan, in public remarks at the Council on Foreign Relations the day that Feinstein came out, you could see him. I was there trying to, you know, he was clearly upset, but I think he's trying to de-escalate this. I don't think you're going to see them throwing bombs back in that direction. And I know that the CIA just wants this to be over. They're tired of this story this week, and they want, you know, to go back to the way things – the state of hostilities before the most recent state of hostilities.
Right. So, I mean, that, you know, before they were the agency that was doing intelligence quietly in the background with nobody noticing, and we were all yelling about NSA. And this
right.
week, NSA is out of the news.
That's right.
But it is not out of the other big – news story that I wanted to talk to you about, which is this remarkable string of court rulings from the FISA court first saying you must destroy the data. This is the 215 data that the government is supposed to destroy after 5 years. Mm-hmm. Then the Northern District of California comes along and says you may not destroy the data. Because you need to preserve it for possible evidentiary use in civil litigation challenging the program. And then the FISA court says, okay, actually, you don't have to destroy the data. You've written about this week. What's going on between the agency, the FISA court, and the plaintiffs and these other courts? Break it down for us.
So this is a great, fun procedural story. And the irony that we end up with at the very end of this is that this huge corpus of 5 years' worth of phone records that so many people who were opposed to the program want to see destroyed are now going to be retained, at least for some time.
Great victory for civil liberties.
Well, I mean, now we should say, and there, you know, there's some irony in it. Now, the data will be segregated and can't be used for intelligence gathering purposes. It is being sort of preserved as evidence. So the TikTok on this is that last Friday, March 7th, Judge Walton on the FISA court issued a ruling that no, the government cannot keep these records for longer than 5 years. And the Justice Department had come to him saying that they wanted to do this because they felt that they might need to preserve those records so that they were discoverable as evidence in six of these civil lawsuits that are going on. Right now, this has been an issue that's been brewing for some time. There's been some reporting on it about the government sort of looking at the records and saying, well, we have to destroy them after 5 years. But if we do that and we're being sued over this program, did we just destroy evidence? So this is a problem and we need to reconcile it. So they go to Judge Walton in late February. He doesn't issue a ruling right away. There are times where the FISA court can turn things around pretty quickly. He waits. He considers it. And on Friday, March 7th, which is 4 days before what the administration thinks is the deadline that they have to start destroying some portion of the records to keep it at 5 years in total, he says, nope, you can't destroy them. The Justice Department then issues notice to the plaintiffs in the civil cases saying we have just had this ruling and unless somebody raises their hand and speaks up and tries to stop us, we're going to have to start destroying these phone records. One of the plaintiffs, I believe it was the Electronic Frontier Foundation, files in the Northern District for a temporary restraining order. It is granted. And then the Justice Department finds itself in the odd predicament of having one judge telling them to destroy the phone records or saying you have to destroy the phone records according to the rules of the program and another judge saying, no, no, not so fast. And then what happens is the Deputy Attorney General has to sort of coordinate on behalf of the Justice Department, make it clear to NSA, hold off on destroying these records because we're going to have to go back to Judge Walton in the FISA court and ask him to settle this. I think from Justice Department's perspective, they would like people to believe that they sort of imagine this course maybe happening all along, that they might get conflicting rulings. They knew that that was certainly a possibility. This did go right up to the wire though, and I think they found themselves not just in that weird position of having conflicting rulings but needing to get this thing settled as quickly as possible before that March 11th deadline was upon them. So ultimately they went back to Judge Walton and he said, okay, so there's another case that says the plaintiffs have filed to preserve this evidence. Fine, we'll preserve it. And Judge Walton, you know, in his ruling on the 7th of February did say, you know, I'm not going to give you permission to destroy this data because up until now, none of the plaintiffs in these civil cases have asked the courts to force the government to keep it. So essentially you're saying you want me to, on a speculative basis, order the preservation of this material as possible evidence, even though none of the people suing you have asked any court to do that.
But it's different once one of them comes
in. Once one of them does, yes. So exactly. So it's this very strange set of circumstances in which, you know, the Justice Department essentially gives a heads up to a group that's suing it saying you might want to go do something that allows us to now have reason to go back and say to this judge, hey, we have a reason to hang on to the data now.
But to go back to my snarky point before, the ironic result of all of this is that a group of civil libertarians who don't want this program to exist at all have just gotten removed one of the principal civil liberties protections in it, which is that the data that is collected gets destroyed after 5 years. And now, as best as I can tell, for as long as this litigation is ongoing, the Justice Department will be under some kind, and the NSA will be under some kind of court order to retain data that for civil liberties reasons it has always meant to destroy on a regular basis. Have you had any conversations with the civil liberties community about whether that's a, you know, a good posture for them to be in?
I think that they would find some comfort probably in the fact that the Justice Department is going to draw up with the NSA some way of taking this data that is past the 5-year point and segregating it for analytic purposes so that, you know, the NSA can't go back into data that's then 6 years old. There's going to be a cutoff where you can't touch it anymore.
But why on earth should that give them any comfort? After all, the NSA has always said we touch it only under the following very restrictive set of rules if there's reasonable articulable suspicion that this is number is associated with terrorism, et cetera. And they don't take any comfort from those rules, which are required by court order, by the way. Why should they take any comfort from an additional court order that says after a certain point you can't touch it for even more restrictive rules?
Well, I suppose they would take some comfort in knowing or believing that they could use it as evidence in their cases. And there are other cases, you know, where not involving the metadata but where some of the groups, I think EFF is one, have asked, you know, the government to retain data so that it can be available for, you know, for evidence going forward. But I think there is an irony in this, right? I mean, if one of the solutions from the point of view of civil libertarians is we'll all be better off and our privacy will be protected if you destroy the data. I mean, how much of a great victory is it to say, well, we're not destroying the data, but we're putting it in this like extra layer of lockbox where we're really, you know, I mean, it's still in the hands of the NSA.
You still have. We went from last week a giant database of everybody's phone records in the hands of the NSA that could only be queried under certain circumstances and was destroyed after 5 years, to a giant, the same giant database in the hands of NSA that now will not be destroyed after 5 years. I think it's a strange and sort of dubious accomplishment for civil liberties.
But if you put it off limits to analytic querying, then, and if it's truly obeyed, then I think that there's some. It's in an evidence locker, right? It's in a cage, basically.
Fair enough. No, if I were, and to be fair, I mean, nobody seems to have responded to this by saying, EFF, congratulations, you just removed one of the great. One of the real civil liberties protections in this thing. So maybe it's not from their point of view a problem. So what sense do you have of you alluded to the Justice Department's attempting to suggest or argue that they had actually teed this up for EFF. What's your sense of the sort of internal dynamics of it within the administration?
Yeah, I think that there may be to some degree, a bit of spinning on Justice's side on that. I mean, I've talked to others who were involved in this process who felt that it was somewhat confused, that it was pushed off until the last minute. One U.S. official told me, we could have gone to the FISA court months ago to settle this problem, and instead we waited until late February. I do think the Justice Department, fairly may have assumed that Judge Walton would settle this pretty quickly. I think it was late February that they first went to him saying – essentially asking him to grant them the authority to keep the data for longer than 5 years. And he didn't decide quickly. He actually, took time to really consider it and weigh it and all the pros and cons. And then issued the decision on February 7th. Now, did it all work out? It worked out. They got it settled before the deadline. They went, the great thing about doing things at the last minute is it only takes a minute to do them. So from their perspective, they handled it fine. Nothing went off the rails. But I think that there are others who are involved in the process who feel like this may reveal to some degree a lack of coordination at the Justice Department between the National Security Division and the Civil Division over how to handle this matter. And I'm not sure that makes everyone, particularly on the intelligence community side, entirely comfortable. I think they would like to see these things maybe dealt with a lot sooner and a lot more decisively.
So let me just end with a speculative question. Do you think we are seeing a shift in the locus of attention to intelligence community scandals away from NSA and toward the CIA, away from surveillance and back to interrogation and its aftermath? Or is this a blip and, next week, 2 weeks from now, the CIA stuff will be a momentary thing and we'll be back to talking about 215 and 702?
I don't know if it's a blip, but I do think that we're not seeing a turn away from surveillance to concern about interrogation. I mean, the Senate Intelligence Committee CIA flap is very much about separation of powers. It's very much a political and to some degree a bureaucratic brawl. I suspect that next week and then into the week after, it will fade away. Because as I said earlier, I don't see a scenario in which the Justice Department brings criminal charges. And that would be the next thing that would escalate it. Of course, the next thing that could really escalate it would be that if, more senators started calling for John Brennan's resignation, as I think a few have already. But I think we'll probably get back to NSA, actually. I mean, Admiral Rogers just had his confirmation hearing to be the next NSA director and the next Cyber Command commander. He presumably will be confirmed. Keith Alexander has.
And how was the hearing? Was it a?
It was revealing, I thought. I mean, I think that he is pretty much in step with the administration on a number of points involving things like metadata, and we have to figure out a way to deal with this and how are we going to handle it. That was just still, by the way, a big unanswered question. By the end of March, I think the administration plans, or the White House plans, to announce what they're going to do with the now 5-year and growing set of phone records. Will phone companies hang on to them? Will a third party take them? Will the NSA keep them? Dutch Ruppersberger, who's the ranking member on the House Intel Committee, has floated a proposal to let the phone companies keep them, but only for the 18 months that they're required to already to keep phone records under, I think, FCC regulations. So we're going to get back to that, I think. You know, with the interrogation flap, I mean, this is something that the CIA loves to point out. You're talking about a program that ended in 2006 and that everything since then has been about the reckoning of, A, the program itself and what were the consequences, and, B, the investigation. So that's much of, a political story. You know, unless John Brennan resigns or unless someone gets indicted, I think that will sort of calm down and we'll be, you know, back to focusing probably on NSA. I mean, but this is the nature of covering this beat, right, is that, you know, our attention sort of shifts, you know, to the latest fire. And then when that dies down, we're going to go back to the place that is going to be, you know, potentially the next one. And I think that's, you know, NSA is having a nice respite. I was actually at a dinner last night on Thursday out in Virginia where Keith Alexander was sort of giving a valedictory kind of speech and, you know, before he steps down. And I believe it was Mike McConnell who got up and said some nice things, former DNI, former NSA director, about General Alexander. And he said, "I would like to thank John Brennan for taking the heat off the NSA this week." And Brennan, who originally had been scheduled to be at the dinner and unfortunately could not make it. So, you know, yeah, the NSA is, I think, enjoying the vacation from people like me calling them up every day. And, you know, but we'll be calling again.
So in the spirit of all things Lawfare being connected by a thousand threads, you and Sophia Yan, our Edward Snowden-esque Hong Kong-based pianist, have been exchanging recipes.
That's right. That's right. I've been learning how to cook Sichuan food, whereas the cookbook that I use calls it Sichuanese food, which is the very fiery, peppery, hot, spicy Chinese food that usually if you go into a Chinese restaurant here, you have to ask for the special menu. So I've known Sophia for years, and she's living in Hong Kong, of course. So I've been sending her all of the bizarre recipes, bizarre for me anyway, that I've been making, and she's been telling me all about the ways to tweak them. And she sent me a recipe for a dish for Taiwanese street food the other day, which had roughly a half a cup of soy sauce in it and had me drinking water for the rest of the night, but it was still pretty good. So she's been sharing her, like, you know, recipes that her mother made for her and things that she likes to eat. So she's more, I guess, on the Taiwanese side of thing, and I'm more on the Sichuan side of things.
But the point is, once again, Sophia is exfiltrating data and uploading it to Lawfare-connected people from Hong Kong.
And it's delicious.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music, as ever, is performed by that Edward Snowden-esque pianist in Hong Kong, Sophia Yan, who will be giving a recital in Washington in July. There are billions of people all over the world who have never heard of the Lawfare podcast. You can help bring the light to them. Tweet us. Do whatever it takes. Share us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. Just get the word out. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.